You're listening to a podcast by BI Norwegian Business School.
Welcome to the new season of Stay Ahead, a podcast from BI Norwegian Business School. This season, we will explore entrepreneurship going beyond the startup. We'll talk to entrepreneurs who've done it and researchers who've studied it about the challenges in growing a young business and how entrepreneurs overcome them. I'm your host, Susanna Pinnock. I'm a former entrepreneur and I'm currently doing a PhD in entrepreneurship here at BI. Our topic today is how do entrepreneurial ventures change as they grow? And I'm joined by Johan Brandt, an Oslo-based entrepreneur and investor. Johan was co-founder and former CEO of Kahoot, the game-based learning platform, which was founded in 2012. I'm also joined by Peter Kalum-Skal, an associate professor at the Department of Strategy and Entrepreneurship here at BI. Peter researches how startups and ventures scale. He has published papers on scaling in leading academic journals, focusing on how firms organize internally and integrate new people as they grow. So welcome to you both. So Johan, Kahoot is used by millions of people worldwide now, but can you take us back to the early years of Kahoot and tell us about when you really started to know you were a growing firm and no longer just a startup?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite easy. It's when you start having users who don't know each other, who is spread across a lot of regions. That's when you feel like you're growing, because you can also start tracking the growth and you'll start seeing your K factor, as they call it. So that's the one. When your support tickets are so many that you actually have to plan them. All those growing pains.
All those growing pains. That's a good start, isn't it? Yeah. So, Peter, I wanted to ask you as well. We're using terms like growth and scaling. Is there a difference? And if so, what is it?
Yeah, let's get these terms kind of like defined. So if you start with growth, as Johan said, like number of users is important. Of course, next off is like, you know, can you sell something to those users? Can you make them pay for your service? And like, what's your market share? So if you have a competitor, like what's your share compared to them? And then, of course, also employee growth. So how many people are in your company? And these things are fairly easy to measure, both if you're a professor like me or if you're an entrepreneur. You can see how many users you have and how many employees you have. So they're very useful numbers. Of course, it's very important to get users, especially if they pay for your service. However, I think in recent years, there's been a lot of focus on just getting growth, so becoming big fast, right? So you might have heard of the term unicorn, so companies that value about $1 billion. Was your code was up there, right? What, Jan?
Yeah, I hate the term because it's an
Why?
Arbitrary term.
Yeah, I think so too.
And also it's funny. Yeah, it could was that because it was on OTC list, which is actually a private list, not a public list. So it was well beyond that if you're using the Norwegian Tax Office. Yeah, unicorns is a way of looking at it.
Yeah.
But it's quite a false.
And I think you're completely right. So there's been like, you know, this kind of over-focus on unicorns, and like some of the companies like Uber or Deliveroo or Snapchat have focused a lot on getting users and getting this kind of big valuation. But they often struggle to become profitable.
But as your point, I was going to say about unicorn, my biggest thing is it's only about a valuation that a small percentage of the owners has set on the business.
Exactly.
So it's a very, very, if you're into metrics and statistics, it's an extremely poor
It's a great
focus
point. It's a great point, right?
And so what would be a good measure? What would be, you know, what would be your choice of measures?
Well, when you asked about growth and so on, we didn't measure just, you know, the amount of users coming in, but as I kind of always say to people is how embedded are you? You know, people talk about a metric, you start asking investors, you know, repeat usage. Uh-huh. But we had to kind of invent, it's wrong to say invent, but we could actually not use normal metrics because we did something that was counter to a lot of other companies like us who go big and get a lot of users to convert. Because in social media, it's where users are the content and actually advertising is paying. It's frequency, low impact, high frequency so that you'll do it often and you scroll around, but it can't be so high, so impactful that you, you know, you can't go about your life. And Kahoot's numbers was important for us was we had low frequency but high impact. So for example, a classroom, you know, one person and 50 people attending, mm-hmm. and you're intensively using for 15 minutes, but they'll go maybe a day before you use it again or 2 days. That means that user is not going to have the repeat usage, but what we're trying to see is how embedded are we with them over time. So we also try to measure the growth with the user, because in Kahoot, one user meant lots of other users. So it's something about Kahoot as well, was really understanding your usage and not measuring your company on other companies' metrics, because then we look really poor.
Yeah, it's a good point, right? So I think actually what's interesting is like looking at what, like how others evaluate you, as you mentioned, Johan, and then like, you know, the internal side, how are you? Are you a healthy company, right? And we talk about scaling, we're talking about like more the internal side. How are you building a healthy company where, as you said, you're kind of maybe embedded with your users and you're working well together. So I think there's these two different elements, and you can see them as an outside and inside perspective, right? That from the outside, you might look big, but you might be like a Frankensteinian monster that doesn't have any, you know, really traction with your users. And you might be a more healthy company that's really embedded with your users and you can grow more organically and more healthy, right? Mm. And that's, I think it's important to look at these two different things and kind of like not just focus on getting the number of users quickly without actually thinking what's the cost of getting that. And like basically that you don't focus like they call like a kind of steroid growth, right? You just want to get some investors and get like scale up fast, but you try building a healthy company that's kind of like embedded with the users and also offer a service that's important to them.
But things I burn a lot for, because when you design your company really very consciously, you have to remember that metrics are like beans you count as an effect, as a cause and effect. So you should set metric goals, but you should actually study is the behavior correctly, because that's more important than getting the first, you know, many, many users. But is the user's behavior correctly, because then you can scale it. Mm-hmm. And that's also the difference about using growth and scale for us. Scaling is something you actively kind of, that's the process. Mm-hmm. And growth is the kind of the consequence.
Yeah, good point.
So what we were obsessed about is Kahoot is a behavioral company. It is actually changing behaviors, and it's the change of behaviors that drives the usage and embedding it. So when we were looking at the metrics early on, we were more interested in, are people shifting behavior? That's more important for us than the amount of users we're getting. Because a lot of companies get caught by that they end up chasing the amount of users and almost designing the product to get the most in, but it's not a long term.
No.
So we've been obsessed, and I think this is why you'll see Kahoot around, you know, 10 years later. The product is basically the same, mm-hmm. because the behavior is very carefully designed for, and there's a lot of other stuff that we can talk about around that. But I think in terms of understanding your users and understanding your metrics and what metrics are you kind of just been counting, it's an exercise of success.
And was that something that you kind of realized from really early days that that's what you had to do to understand what was going to fuel your growth? And did you have any problems with like external people not getting that logic, not getting that? Yeah.
And also particularly people say, oh, hindsight is such a beautiful thing. That's very frustrating when you actually have designed for it. You know, people think, oh, okay, it was a fluke and it was a, you know, blah, blah, blah. Luckily, we can prove all of this because we designed for it and we have the thing. So yeah, we didn't know it was going to work. But once it worked, we could repeat it because we knew what
we
were doing, right?
We wasn't.
And that was a very important thing because if you know what you're doing, you can repeat it. Mm-hmm. A lot of companies also struggle, and particularly when you get new management, they didn't create the original stuff. So they don't want to change it because they don't really know how it sticks together. So we designed very carefully for it, but we did a lot of tests. What we do is when we design, we look for signs. So we often look at the behavior the user has as the sign of, we're on the right path. So on Kahoot, one of the first things we did was find a photograph of a builder in a meeting room putting his hands up in the air. And we said, if we can achieve that with the software, that's a success. If we can get a behavior where the person is doing this, mm-hmm. that's a success. So you design for that and you're seeing, okay, I get that. That I can repeat. I'm very proud of that because it's something people don't think about. And then afterwards, you can start counting the beans of how many times it's happening, which is very important. Mm-hmm. But cash in your company is a consequence of success. And I often think when things kind of go wrong is when you have to turn up the revenue and you have to kind of meet all these metrics of revenue and maybe not thinking long term. That's a problem with the stock market, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Indeed. So when you're talking about the investors, yeah, they have urgency. They put all this money in. They want to see it. Or before, they're asking you, you have to do this and that. And we actually said no to some very prominent investors because they wanted us to do stuff. We were like, well, you don't know the business then. You obviously don't get it. I am and respect you. You're amazing. You built unicorns, but...
That's actually very interesting, right? So there is this Harvard professor, Tom Eisenman, who talks about what he calls the speed trap, which is exactly when companies just taking the money because they think they have to do that, right? Mm. That, you know, we have to get as much funding in because that looks good for us. And then they don't really like think, okay, actually, like to grow, it's going to be hard for us to get the next number of users and get what these investors want, right? So they can like caught up and they're just trying to run as fast as they can and not... Mm. And not really focusing on how to build a company, and then like they burn out, right? So actually being able to say no is probably a underestimated skill for many entrepreneurs, right? Because they think they have to say yes when people come with money.
Absolutely, and your current investors want that because it drives their valuation up and makes their fund look good. So that, you know, so you have to actually, if you're going to run this game, you really need to understand everyone's motivation because your investors are running their portfolio. You're actually just a metric mover in their portfolio so they can raise the next fund. Yeah. So it's, you know, good investors are able to balance that and bad investors are not going to treat you that way. Mm-hmm. And also the other one is you do raise a lot of cash when you need it. Yeah. So if you know you have a plan, okay, I'm going to burn through, I'm going to do all these activities, maybe hardship is coming. We encourage our companies to raise money, not because we knew this downturn was going to come this way, but we could see there's going to be tougher markets and having money in the bank account now is a good thing. So I totally agree. But it's like those who just do it because it's what you do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They and it's very expensive to have money sitting in your bank account because the investors are having a clock ticking. And in the end, you have very short time to deploy it.
Yeah.
So going back to maybe the early few years as you were starting to see this really kind of sustainable growth and you feel confident or a little bit more confident that the company is growing, you start to take on some new people. Can you talk a little bit about the challenges of that and who you identified and how you identified who you needed?
Yeah, we're proud of how we run the company in the beginning because we actually run the company for the first 2 years. Everyone was management for hire. So all of us, there was no employees from 2012 to summer 2014, which meant we only paid for the resources we needed. So we then run a very lean, very, very lean business. And when we start getting our first investor, you kind of need to be employed in the venture you're raising money for. Mm-hmm. So this is the time to kind of, okay. So then we already had kind of a suite of people we worked with, contractors and ourselves. And you can start thinking, okay, who should be full-time and who shouldn't be? So that was one part of it. So you did kind of, you drew up like a metric where we're like looking at all the skills and all the people we had. And then we start figuring out who goes full-time, who goes 50%, who comes to contracting. I also got in quite early. One of my study buddies from when I studied entrepreneurship in Boston, who was an amazing entrepreneur and amazing people person to help us build a culture from day one that was engineer driven on that side. And then my co-founder, Jamie, was building a product team and then building a unique culture within those. So it's also your first hires have to be culture creators. Yeah. Super important. I mean, they have to be amazing what they do, but they have to be equally or more interested in building culture and good people. And my style was always to say, I'll do the last interview, but I'll walk with them. I'll always go for a walk because then you don't, you know, so then you get to know each other on a culture basis. But I knew those I get to walk with already gone through so many filters that they're going to be, you know, a formality. Yeah. I think I only declined one or two people. That to tip it forward.
And what was the cultural sort of signs that you were really looking for that would gel with your firm ethos and the others who were already in the business?
First was like more technical stuff. You know, are you able to work in team and design together? So our hiring process was actually designing together, solving problems, same on engineering side, doing code reviews together to see, you know, all those things. Morten, the CTO founder, had a very clear rule saying you might be the best engineer in the world, but if you might not be the best engineer for Kahoot. Mm. So really understanding, you know, the group output. So we measured on that. For me, it was important that we could go for a walk and have silence together and be comfortable. And because if you're not that, this is about the early stage employees, which is, I think it's different when you're filling in gaps and it's more of a machine. So that was important. But another interesting thing is when we went full time and we started to hire more people who had more experience, we paid ourselves too little because we wanted to save our cash. And first investors were like, you have to pay yourself more because you kind of, other people have to come in and you need to have some kind of balance. So that was the other part was early employees and early people, you know, they want stock and they're keen on working and some of them are quite successful coming in, right? Mm-hmm. And that was the other part, allowing people to buy shares because we did hire successful people early on. That was part of our culture thing was high for potential, which meant potential is high efficiency and very self-running. And then really young people or inexperienced people coming for another career. So yeah, we try to be quite holistic and not run too fast, which is, I'm quite proud at how calm we were able to be in the first, probably until 2015.
But as you're creating your business, you're also creating its own market. So you're doing a double job there.
When I talk about like, I have to define my own metrics, it's because it hasn't been done before what we're doing. We are doing, you know, we're building a product that's has a unified behavior from kindergarten to boardrooms to, you know, the hospital and proving to the market that what we're designing for the kindergarten is exactly the same behavior you'll see in a multinational boardroom. And then proving that we're going to charge there and we're going to do this there. So you're going to have to, so this is a very, you have to be willing to take things slowly and prove the point and hire people who are willing to kind of not get stressed. Because I think the more load you have, the less stress you can have in one way.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So, and when you started to take on much bigger numbers, and you say when you use the term earlier on about it, it becomes a machine. How did you keep integrating them? Did that remain important to keep that ethos and that calm, deliberate?
You're also gonna burn people out. You're gonna, you know, stress is also a sign of not knowing what you're doing, which we didn't. So you have to be calm, but it looks like you know what you're doing. Because I mean, we were literally doing stuff we had never done before, right? And then trying to get people in on specialist area who knew what they were doing or willing to learn. But it's also interesting. I think when I left, we were still like 50 people, so we weren't adding a lot of people.
Right, so it was still manageable to keep that culture.
Yeah, and
in
then
the way
it was
that you wanted it.
What also happened with when you're scaling a company, there's also a shift of people who are the early stage people who then chooses to leave completely. So whole teams will go out, and you have to kind of rebuild. So I think after I left, there was a period where so many people left and so many people added that was still probably 55 people in 2018. And then you find your track. And then, you know, from 2018 until now, I mean, it's added, you know, 600 people. Mm-hmm. But that's very different to scaling the early stage where you're setting, you know, every position is new.
Yeah. So Peter, is those sorts of integration issues, are they reasonably typical? Is that what most startups go through, or is it?
I think what Johan is telling about, like especially with this cultural fit, there is like a balance between like, you know, when you find people, you look for what you say cultural fit and their skills, right? And in research, we call that kind of like you have this called interpersonal attraction, right? So you said you can go on a walk with them and actually you don't want to leave quickly after that walk, right? So that's, of course, important that you can hire people that fits in. And early on, like you're probably able to find people who want to work in a startup, who want some share and actually may have the same dreams and the same goals. And that kind of makes it a bit easier. I think later on, there's this kind of like, you know, transitioning period where you have like you're between the early hires and the startup culture and a more machine culture, as you said, Johan. And there, like, I think there's often this kind of challenge that you're starting often hiring people from large corporations or you're hiring people who don't get share, who already know they're there for a paycheck. And they might be hard to integrate, especially, for example, like what I've seen in my research, when you hire people from large corporations, they often have this idea, okay, you hired me to fix a particular problem. I come with my particular skill set, and now you should listen to how I do things. And then you have, like, on the other hand, you have the entrepreneur saying, you know, but I built up this company so to this level, right? So I also know things. Mm. And then you have, like, can you have these kind of conflicts of integrating them?
And you end up with several cultures.
Yeah.
Which probably the one of the things also when we left, we saw that is the founder culture and this new culture going to coexist?
Yeah.
And it's unhealthy for a company to have frictions. It's also, it kind of has to have, it's better to have one culture than having two competing cultures. Maybe you feel like my culture is better than that culture, but that's actually going to kill the machine. And I think early on, it's also, it's, you have different type of people. We hired excellent coders who said, once we turn about 40 people, I'll leave.
Yeah.
Because it's something with dynamic and so on. I was something I wasn't aware of. I mean, because I'm very focused on the first employees are the most important in the company because they're validating the founders are in love with their idea, but the first ones are actually validating your idea. Mm-hmm. So they become extremely important for actually kind of knowing that you're growing and that you're on the path. But also, I wasn't aware of this. A lot of said, of course, we come early on and, you know, we joined for you guys. So when I left, a lot of them was like, I'm so disappointed.
Yeah.
And I left because I joined for you guys. I'm here because of you. I mean, later on, they don't join for the leader. They joined because of the team or challenged. And so that was also quite a big difference. And I did not really realize how my and my Jamie's and Martin's presence was a big part of them joining.
That's very interesting for a couple of reasons. To start with, these two different cultures, right? They have published a study that kind of showed the exact same thing, right? They're at a certain time, when you're a certain number of people and you're starting to hire people, you have this tendency to create two different cultures. And often this happens quite slowly. So you might not be aware of it until like you suddenly realize we have two different cultures. You know, and then you have some issues, and people are already starting to like have some tensions. And the second thing you said about the founder, like you know, often what we see is like that the founders kind of imprint a bit themselves in the company. So the company kind of like you know, it's a bit of it kind of reflects you a bit and your co-founders as well. And of course, when you leave, like there's a big part of the culture, right? So that's a huge challenge for these startups, like you know. How do we survive when the people who like shaped us are leaving, right?
But this is an interesting thing because I one of my goals with Kahoot was that we could leave and a company would continue. That's a that's a measure of success. That is not so that was important for us. So we're also trying to be very aware. That's why you also want to imprint it because it means people will carry it on. They'll make their own. I had a saying when people joined saying, our culture and our product is. Everyone's experience before Kahoot as well. When you come with it, you come with all your experience with your backstory, and that's part of the Kahoot story.
Yeah.
So that people also felt like, okay, my story is the Kahoot story, and then you can talk about why I joined and what I do. So it's not just the one true story, which makes it also very interesting. And that's our way of doing it. But there's also another thing I read, and I hope it's true, said, particularly with men, that when you find a company, the emotional attachment and signs in your brain is the same as with kids, which is a danger.
Yeah.
And it's a good thing because you fall too much love with it and so on. But also now afterwards, it's my baby and it's out there running and doing stuff and I'll have all my opinions as a daddy, but also means I'll have to be careful because I might not be right.
And also as the firm grows, your role as a co-founder will have to change in terms of what you do and how you manage and that sort of thing. How did you find that affected you in the years that it was growing?
Well, as someone who never wanted to be the CEO, that was interesting because I felt like I was always doing a job I wasn't skilled to do. But I tried to do what I was good at. And it was painful to not be so day-to-day involved in the product. Because in the beginning, I was shaping the product with the rest of the team.
Because you're in love with your product.
Yeah, and also that's what I do. I'm a concept developer. I develop products, I strategize, I create brands attached to it, you know, or the brand is the product. More and more, my job was to go out there and knock down doors and be on stage and drive the brand and the presence and, you know, and being the vision. When you're the vision, it's not just, it's what I see. It's trying to listen to everyone in the company, what they're learning and what's going on, listen to the market and then being like a kaleidoscope.
Yeah.
And then after a while, I really liked that. But I was, in the beginning, too much of a product CEO. And then I think down the line, and I now are doing it better than I did at Kahoot. But it was also trying to grow and realize that, okay, I can't be the product designer anymore.
Yeah.
Then someone else has a...
So in terms of research, Peter, presumably different entrepreneurs will have a different response to this changing role, and some will want to stay in that same role,
exactly,
right?
Yes, exactly. I was thinking of when you said it couldn't be the product design anymore. There's this horror story from Henry Ford. So Henry Ford like designed the Ford T and the whole factory, and he was very much into the product. He was like, you know, it was a racing driver before he became a business owner, and he was so in love with the car, right? He refused to change it. So even when, like, you know, sales were going down, and his management team and his own son, they kind of like developed their kind of alternative on the side. Like Henry Ford just freaked out when he found out and smashed the car and humiliated his son, created complete chaos and basically like nearly killed his own company because he refused to let go. Right, he's not like, I am the product. Right, so there are some entrepreneurs who had that, who do this. And what you describe, Johan, is probably that you're kind of more okay. You're realizing you have to shift your role. Like, so basically, you find kind of a new identity in the company, and that's probably very hard.
It's super hard, and we definitely were holding on too hard to our ideas, as well. Because you do a lot of those mistakes. But that's why I think you're more successful when you're on your second, third company, because then you're starting to realize and see your own patterns. And so and also you hear all the stories and you try not to be that, but it's very hard to observe yourself.
Yeah. Did you have any kind of external support network that kind of said, nah, come on, you've got to start being a commercial CEO and not a product guru anymore or anything like that?
Did you definitely have those guidance? I had a lot of people who were actually saying, stop, feel like you're not mastering the job. You are mastering the job. And actually, you know, those people saying that you have to do this and that, they're wrong. So it was really nice to have people from external who are very successful, and I could go back in the room and hold my own and say, actually, no, this is what we should be doing. And then others are, yeah, exactly. You have to let go of this. You cannot be in those details. You're making it impossible for them to do their job. Because you come as like as this father, exactly, going in saying, yeah, but and that's a job, which is difficult. And I thought that was hard for all the founders to kind of.
Yeah. And then presumably if you're one of those people who just can't let go of some of those things, Peter, you kind of know this better than me, I guess. But, you know, it really impacts the firm.
But presumably. I think what's interesting, actually, I think maybe an explanation here. So you say like you see it like as a baby, but you also say there's something like, you know, you watch from the outside now. So maybe you become the parent, like, who, like, you know, can send your kid off to college and like they see how they're doing, right? And then there are some who are like the only helicopter parents, right, who are there all the time and can never let their kids go, right? And probably like that's not very healthy, right? And I think maybe that's kind of like how you work with in your mind, right? If you can see it as something you have to let go, even though you're emotionally invested in it, that's probably a good thing. Rather, you see something that you have to control, right? That it can't survive without you.
Yeah, you can't control a company that is growing. I think that's the biggest mistake. And we designed an operation model to avoid having this board to CEO control of the company. So I call it the inverted leadership model. But basically, I put myself as a CEO at the bottom of the triangle. And then my job was to empower the four leaders, which was my co-founders and more team, to like... Martin had full autonomy on the platform. My job was to make sure we were aligned. Mm-hmm. So he had full autonomy. So my job was to make sure everyone was aligned. And, you know, if I set the course this way, he could make exactly his decision where it should go. But at the same time, I didn't put the course that way without knowing what they wanted. So, and creating a model where everyone had autonomy on different levels was very frustrating for the more traditional board members and others, because they want to go in and say, can you tell them just to do this? And I'm going, no, because they actually... We hire them because they know better how to do this than us. And I had board members saying, yeah, but what does a 20-year-old person know about this? So, well, they know everything about it. It's their culture and they're living this and they're actually super skilled on this. And that was one of my downfalls, that I was designing an operational model that was so new for the people around me. Mm-hmm. And of course, when you lack when you're lacking the metrics and everything, it's very hard to have it. So once I left, that flipped. And you got the control focus. You got the pyramid flipped. And of course, a lot of people also leave because it's not for them. And that's why I'm saying about the cultures that you have to choose. It's better that it flips than trying to do both. So in that sense, once you choose, that's fine. Then it should flip.
So you say Kahoot now is like more like a traditional enterprise, like top-down.
It's extremely centralized driven and for good and bad.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think it's not good for product development and freedom and so on, but it's probably quite good for keeping the momentum and having control on the stock market.
Do you think it's unavoidable that you cannot get forced into becoming like the triangle?
Well, I think it's important that maybe early stage you do that, and at some point you flip or you go into a more traditional model. It's a lot of those companies I also looked at who have scaled with all the untraditional models. They have at some point hit a wall.
Mm. Yeah.
Because as you're saying, you're adding people who are not used to those models.
Yeah.
And maybe at that point you need that.
Yeah.
So I think it's like it's just a question of when. When should it happen?
And do you have any kind of, I mean, as an investor now and with your experience with Kahoot and seeing it since you left, do you have any sense of when the right or wrong time is, or what
the markets
are?
I think it's completely product independent or company independent. One of the things I left, there's many reasons to leave, but one of the things I wanted to do when I left was to be an active owner. I wanted to understand what is it to be an active owner as a founder. And also I wanted to be an evangelist. So it's one way of impacting your company is to be out there talking about why it exists, what's important to look for, because it's also a way for new employees to learn it. When the management who is in there didn't create it, they don't exactly know how to tell about the founding years. So our job is out there and tell the story because they'll be listening to it to a certain degree. So active ownership is also quite interesting. So instead of trying to control, more trying to inspire, leading from behind, which I learned from, I think it's called Ben Zimmerman, who's the Boston Philharmonic, he runs that, and he talks about if you're the fifth violinist, you should always play as if you're leading, because all of a sudden they do something wrong and you're ready. So we try to instill that in Kahoot as well. That's the point of autonomy. Always act as a leader in what you're doing, because all of a sudden people ask you.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I love building companies. I love building products. And I think culture and leadership is, and people build companies.
Yeah.
And products are people.
Yeah, I love this idea of being an external evangelist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think that's a nice, because it's, did you, what was it that you felt you weren't able to do as CEO that you were able to do as an external active owner evangelist?
When you're a CEO, you have so much responsibility and you have to answer to all these things. But once you're external, you have all this freedom.
I don't have
to take responsibility for performance. You can more talk. So you can talk more about the foundational things. What's important to look for. It's a very nice role to have, in many ways. But of course, it's also something frustrating. It's like, that's a bad choice.
I can see them doing this wrong. And if only they listened to me.
Which,
if only
is much
I could
easier
still
from
be.
from that side. But those things are I unfortunately think a lot of companies scale. They copy and paste from the big boys' book, and they end up becoming very similar, all of them. This is why I have problems with the VC model, because it basically the winners are picked through a very homogeneous model. So the companies are very homogeneous. Also means when the market changes, the financial market, they're not resilient, because they're all doing that and their teams are set up similarly. And so it all kind of becomes a domino place. So that's also why we wanted to structure us differently. Because you're not going to win over the others if you are copying them.
No.
Because you'll all have the same weaknesses and be brought down by the same.
And the resilience in an organization is going to be, So this is what we're doing again and again. And the company that created Kahoot, or co-created Kahoot with Tanu, is called We Are Human. And that's what we do. We create companies, and we never create a company that has been created before in a market that existed before.
That is quite interesting, right? So it's a very, I think, one of the most established thing in kind of organizational sociology is that stakeholders tend to force companies to become like copy-paste version of themselves, right?
Yeah.
So you have all these kind of startups that kind of look the same and act the same. They're all running lean startup. They're all organized in the same way. So there's kind of this force doing that. As you said, kind of creates a domino effect. So I think, but now you're an investor. So how do you avoid that? Like, how do you become like the one who stands out, right?
Well, it's a little bit parallel back to my degree as an artist. So, you know, when you're an artist, I thought it was really funny that, you know, at one point I got very unpopular. I was in East London in a gallery, and I was like, we all dress so independently, we all look the same, right? Because whenever it's so different, it actually becomes the same. And then I got very unpopular. And then I wanted to get into creation and then, you know, buy art and create. And then it's the same, it happens in the same way. It's very easy to fall into these cultures of equal.
Yeah.
And then you're saying I'm an investor, but I'm actually a founder. I invest. So what I do is I build companies still, and I invest into companies which I can learn from or can be suppliers to what we do or customers. But it's the diversity, that we find interesting in many, many ways. Age, products, markets. And there's no right rule. But I have to say, it's like what's interesting about We Are Human, which is the company I run to create companies, we're like the opposite of Askeladden or Rocket Internet. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with what they're doing, because what they're doing is execution companies. Pick a market, deploy McKinsey's and bum. But our role is to create companies and markets that hasn't existed. So then you have to do it very differently. But that's also why we build it at a certain point and then we leave. So that's also being aware of what is your role, what is that you do, what's your DNA, and what do you do in this thing. And I think it was something we instilled into Kahoot that was important early on when we're growing. We also realized that the market we're in, the biggest problem is everyone who's not doing it. So actually we reached out to all the other digital companies who are trying to break the market, saying, look, we're actually trying to do the same thing. So let's kind of divide the classroom together and just go for it and move the users between our products, because then we win. Mm-hmm. And I think that was kind of unusual for a lot of the ones who were always going head to head and creating a culture where we were always the ones that people came to. Mm-hmm. And that's important. So then you go down to the level of you hiring, be open, mm-hmm. you know, don't have this attitude of this and that. So.
Yeah, but it sounds like, so when you talk about the companies, that it's like, you know, they are the smaller companies. They're still on the cusp of, say, becoming something, right?
Yeah. Well, not all of them. Yeah. One was a company that was big in the market we went in, said they're never going to raise VC money. And here we come, and we took the VC money and we ran past them, but we befriended them. And we were still beating the big boys. And paper-based teaching and whatnot. So it is important to see what your market is, and actually it might be that your competitor is actually your collaborator for a long, long time. And this is why also it's extremely important for us to build a brand. So when you talk about also growth, mm-hmm. we measured the brands. Where did it go? How was it looked upon? Because you defend what we learned about also when you want to protect your companies, defend by usage, which I learned by the guy who built Virgin and Orange brand. And he said, defend by usage is the best thing to do. So the reason to go big in usage is actually you can defend it by usage. And we measured the Kahoot brand in terms of perception, but also very important when you have metrics which are not repetitive, is to also measure, do people think about it? Do they interact with it on a brand level, but not necessarily with the product? Because that means they'll come back. So we very consciously built a brand as much as we built a product, which is why now Kahoot is top 2 brand in Europe in 30 to 12. And I think they were top 5 in the US, beating TikTok and Apple. It's quite incredible.
That is incredible.
And in Norway, people are not aware of the amount of value that sits in that brand. And that means you can buy other products. People, it's easier to hire. When you have a big brand, it's easier to scale.
Yeah.
Because you basically don't have to explain to people who you are, why. People know they know your values, they know about this, all this stuff. And so it's a massive magnet.
Yeah.
And at what point did you think you started to realize that that was as important as it is?
I knew this because my career before Kahoot was building brands and games.
Ah, right.
And so on. So I've been, and my last name is Brand, so come on. it's one of like the final things to talk about in scaling is to realize how important it is to build a brand. And we measure our company's scale and growth on velocity. And that means, you know, finding how fast you're moving to your target. And with the brand is the signals of recognition, how much is talked about. We measured on Google that we were more searched for than Spotify on Friday evenings. Very important for us because Kahoot had to be a playful platform. Mm-hmm. So that was metrics that was probably more important for investors than anything. Mm-hmm. And we were able to tell them that we are more sought after than we're more searched for than on Spotify in the US in Friday evenings. And they were like, oh my God.
So you did have some nice news to tell the VCs that they wanted to get some metrics.
Yeah, they hadn't
thought
really
of it. They really loved it.
And we thought that's behavior and we'll convert it to that and why. And all of a sudden, it's a real metric, but also it's a soft metric. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the most powerful things and most undervalued, understood things of Kahoot is the power of the brand for scaling. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And when you talk about the brand, so what's your idea of like, what should the brand stand for?
Well, the brand should be what's interesting with Kahoot, the very basic part of the brand is the product in the sense that Kahoot in French comes from Kahoot, which come under something together to protect yourself from the rain. In English, written with a C, it means that you're in Kahoot together, which means, for example, that the village is in cahoot with the guerrilla outside against the government. So for us, it was the student and the teacher were in cahoot for better education. So when they're normally on the different side of the table, it was very important that the brand was you together. So when you're in a party and you're going, what do we do with all these people? Cahoot brings you together.
Yeah.
And you're doing something a bit that you shouldn't be doing. So the brand should stand for being a bit naughty, you know, breaking the rules, but you're doing it together for something good. Okay. So that was the core of the brand. And then the way it was designed was also super important. It was like Pixar. So it's a new brand for the kids, but it's something you recognize from your childhood when you're older. Mm. And then you forge together and create a new experience. One of the reasons why Disney invested into us is because they recognize the brand. They could see that you guys understand it. And the other part of that is you get an unfair advantage and you can acquire other companies. The brand is it's a very kind of, we wanted to build a brand that was as big as a product, put it that way.
Yeah.
So it's it was very consciously built, and I molded it actually on Pondus, the Norwegian cartoon, which kids want to read, but it's for daddy. but it's interesting because we had to prove that something has something that kids is drawn upon, but actually adults want to use as well. Yeah. So our ideal user, and this was very difficult to get our designers and investors to understand. Designers want to design for the portfolio and what looks cool. And we said, no, you have to design for a 35-year-old woman who lives in the middle of America and shops at Walmart. This product has to sit in Walmart, because that's the person who is our gatekeeper, who is going to introduce this. That's the growth. And it cannot look like it's for hipster London. It has to look like something's for them. And then we were quite certain if the product is good enough. And this happened at BAE. We came with the product and said, oh, I don't think I can use it here, because what if the students don't like it? And we were like, oh, the students will come with it and they'll tell the teachers they want it. Because when you're older, it's the effect that you're looking for. So this is the point of the brand. Really understanding, like, designing for behavior. And behavior drives scale. Behavior drives growth.
That's so fascinating. Peter, any last questions before we say thank you to Johan for joining us today?
I think I have one last question for Johan. And that is, like, so I teach entrepreneurship. So I teach the second year bachelor's and the first year master's. So people in their early 20s and maybe a bit above. Do you have like a piece of advice for them? Or some maybe an advice you'd get yourself, like, you know, way back when?
That's difficult. I think one of the things for me was to probably realize being an entrepreneur is to recruit people to your own dream and make the dream bigger than your own dream. So it's like talked about how I recruited Kahoot. It's like, and particularly for me, it was when my dream matched with other founders, when I realized that my dream was, and that's when we founded the company. Your dream, my dream. It's a bigger dream. Let's go and do it.
Yeah.
So that was probably.
We're in cahoots.
Yeah.
We're in cahoots, yeah.
Yeah. So that was probably the one, is to kind of, you know, test your dream against others. And if your dreams match or become a bigger dream, then you know you can build something. And you don't really build a company unless you hire people. I mean, so if you can't hire, you're not building a company.
How true. So thank you very much to my guest, Johan Brandt. Thank you for your time. Peter Kalmsgaard, lovely to see you as well. And thank you for a fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
This is a BI production. Listen to more podcasts. Go to bi.no/podcasts.